This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Today, multi-award winning author Thomas Keneally talks about whether stories really can change the world and discusses the future of the novel. He believes the novel will survive the next century. He should know, he's written more than 30 of them. Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review discusses the US online department store giving DJs and Maya a run for their money. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City lists her top five most annoying social media habits and suggests how to be a considerate social media user. There's currently a child welfare crisis going on in New South Wales. 18,000 children are in out-of-home care, 12,000 due to a court order. The Minister for Family and Community Services, Prue Goward, would like to see more of those kids placed into adoptive families. We'll hear why. And seven times Tour de France winner Lance Armstrong was a hero to many. Now he's remembered as a drug cheat and a liar. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity reviews the new doco, The Armstrong Lie. That's all coming up on the Hope Mornings weekly podcast. Thomas Keneally is one of Australia's greatest storytellers. He's best known for the Booker Prize-winning work Schindler's Ark, though recently he's been releasing more non-fiction. Thomas Keneally is also an ambassador for the Big Picture Film Festival, taking place from the 19th to the 29th of March. And Thomas Keneally has taken a few moments out of his morning to speak to us today. Hi, Thomas.
How are you?
Thanks so much for your time today.
Not at all.
Thomas Keneally, can storytelling actually change the world?
Definitely. Not fast enough. but it can alter attitudes. You can, certainly my attitudes have been altered by film and even by popular entertainment. Well, you can't measure it, but the probable impact that gays appearing as recognized gays in sitcoms, for example. Also, of course, the impact of movies like Hotel Rwanda. You've got to think that attitudes towards present follies, as well as lamentations about what happened in the past, will change attitudes a bit.
Maybe it's easier to see hypocrisy and to feel empathy when it's up there on a big screen in front of us. That can maybe it can highlight away our attitudes that we have ourselves.
Yes, and it never goes astray to assert that we're all human beings. I wish that would be asserted in relation to our present immigration policy, but that's another story. Mm. The reason I'm interested in the big film is that I've always been an admirer of Bill Cruz, whose idea this festival, this very lively festival, is. This is its second year, and I have always been in esteem of Bill for his standing up for human rights in a way, once again, not all the clergy do. Mm. Many do, but amongst those who do, he's very notable. The question was to get a program together of films that relate to social justice and yet are extremely entertaining at the same time, that are seductive because they're both entertainment, but they carry a heavy social justice clout as well, but one you don't necessarily feel when you're in the midst of the narration. And my son-in-law, Eddie Cockerell, who was an American who immigrated to Australia when he married my daughter, he is the artistic director. And what Eddie doesn't know about film is not worth knowing. He can tell you the name of the pet dog of a focus puller in a Czech film of the 1950s. You know,
right.
He's absolutely encyclopedic knowledge, and particularly of world cinema, not just American cinema.
Sounds good. I'm speaking to multi-award-winning author Thomas Keneally. He's won the Man Booker Prize at least four times and the Miles Franklin Award another four times. I think winning it once would be an achievement enough for most people. We're actually speaking about the Big Picture Film Festival, which is coming up in March. Now, Thomas Keneally, what are you most looking forward to in this festival program?
I'm really looking forward to films like Belle and the one about the Nigerian Civil War, the feature movie about the Nigerian Civil War, whose name is Half a Yellow Sun. And then there's the first feature film it's called Beatrice's War. It's from Timor, the first
ever feature film out of Timor, is it?
Yes, absolutely. And it concerns the story of one woman's conviction to remain true to the man she loves and the country for which she fought.
Well, that sounds really interesting, yeah.
It deals with the problem of what happens after the war when you've struggled for certain human rights. How do you then make sure that they're maintained after the war? The opening night is an historical fiction about an 18th century African woman called Belle, who appeared in British society and at a time when people were discussing whether slavery should exist or not, passionately either way.
I hear that this is one for fans of Downton Abbey.
It's a very glamorous film, actually. Mm. Just because this is a social justice-based film festival, people shouldn't think the films will die of earnestness. The missing picture, I saw a few clips of that. Now, that's an extraordinary film.
This is the one we're giving away tickets to, Thomas, so I'm interested to hear more about this one.
This is the one made by a fellow called Rithi Pan, who's a Cambodian, and he uses, it sounds crazy, but you ought to see it, it uses clay figures that he has made to represent the people who are in that situation. I mean, when you put them all together in assemblage, you forget in about 20 seconds that they're not real people. Mm. And it's about, of course, the Cambodia's Khmer Rouge atrocities committed between 75 and 79. It's a non-fiction film, but it looks like a fiction film. I mean, it has the clout of a feature film. It was nominated for
An Oscar, wasn't it?
Foreign language film.
Yeah.
At
the Oscars.
The Academy Oscars last year, yeah. And it hasn't been seen in Australia before now, so this will be its first outing.
I'm speaking to the multi-award winning author, Thomas Keneally, about the Big Picture Film Festival. But, of course, I can't pass up the opportunity to talk a little bit about books and writing. Now, there's so much competition from technology, from film, from so many other forms of entertainment. But, Thomas Keneally, do you think that books will survive into the 22nd century?
I'll tell you what, writing will survive, and extended writing of the kind of the novel will survive. It's very interesting to me, this is wishful thinking because it might all change, but it's very interesting to me that the physical book has lasted. I mean, in America, they're selling 50-50.
Yeah.
In Australia, it's slightly less, but within a year or two, it'll probably be 50-50 or 60-40. But it'll be interesting to see if it reaches a point at which it won't go any further. I just don't know. I look at all the things that exist now, including going to the movies, which we do as communal events, but we don't need to technologically.
Yes.
We could probably order or acquire a lot of these films ourselves and watch them at home, but we wouldn't have the tribal experience of watching them with other passionate people who are interested in film.
Yes.
And it's because we're tribal people and like to laugh together and like to be appalled even together that we go to the cinema. Mm. And I think because we're tactile and sensual animals, we reading animals, thank God, we still like the print book in certain circumstances.
Yeah, very, very true.
You're a writer. You'll be still writing, whether your book appears electronically or in the Gutenberg, the print form. So definitely there'll always be people berserk enough, demented enough, crazy enough to want to write.
That's true. Now, before I let you go, you know, you've done so many amazing works, but what are you most proud of, or what do you think has actually had the most impact?
Oh, boy. Well, I am proud. I'm ambiguous about all my books. They're like love letters you write to people whom you're no longer involved with.
Yes.
They might be perfectly good love letters, but you don't want to go back and watch them. But there are a number that I remember with pride. And in the spirit of this festival, there's Towards Asmara, which was a book which is credited a bit with having some influence on what happened in Eritrea.
Yes.
But then, of course, a man who was a perfectly good rebel leader became a tyrant in Eritrea. And so the effect was sadly short-term. Mm. But while they were struggling for their independence and an end to the atrocities committed on them by Mengistu, the Stalinist leader of Ethiopia, while it was all on, that book had a bit of a political outfall, and it's very rare that you do get books that have any political outfall at all. So I'm rather proud of that in a quiet way. I don't tell people. This is just between you and me.
Sure. Thanks so much.
And right. The other thing I'm proud of is having survived 50 years as a writer. You've got to be either hugely determined or an absolute psychopath to last 50 years, or a mixture of both. And you've got to...
Which one are you, Tom?
Punishment.
Yes, which one are you?
I think I'm both. I mean, the whole thing is, we talk about writing being tough, and it is tough. Mm. But on the days it's not tough, it gives us a high hardly anyone else gets out of their job.
That's true.
It's just such a transcendent joy to write. And that's why it's an addiction rather along the lines of alcoholism, actually.
All right. Well, yes, I can see what you mean by that. It's very hard to give up, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I haven't given it up at 78, and... I'm still writing novels, though. The novel, I think, is the biggest game in town. People who only read nonfiction don't know what a delight it is to inhabit a good novel. But nonfiction's fantastic, don't get me wrong. But it's like the documentary movie and the feature movie. They can both be done well.
Yes, absolutely. No, I do agree with you there. Well, thank you so much for your time this morning, Tom Skeneally.
Yes, and good luck to you and all your millions of listeners.
I wish.
Than John Laws.
Oh, dear. That's Tom Skeneally. He's an ambassador for the Big Picture Film Festival. It is taking place from the 19th to the 29th of March, and you can find out more online at thebigpicture.org.au. US luxury department store Neiman Marcus is targeting Australian customers, putting pressure on local department stores like David Jones. Kai Chow is on the line from the Australian Financial Review. Hi, Kai.
Good morning, Katrina.
Just how much of an impact is Neiman Marcus having on the Australian market?
Well, let's just say that they're certainly taking advantage of the low Australian dollar, and I think Australians' desire for choice, and they're making some very aggressive marketing moves to try to court Australian consumers, especially the ladies. The women's clothing, shoes and handbags are the big sellers here in Australia, even though the website for Australia has only been up for about a year, year and a half or so, it's already near one of their top selling destinations in the world.
So what kind of growth are they experiencing in terms of their expansion?
Well, look, overall, this is a fascinating difference between our department stores and America's. They get about a third of their sales through their website, and we say in David Jones only gets about 2%. Now, in terms of their online business, that's growing 15% each year. Now, that's on a global basis, but it's clearly becoming a more and more important part for these American department stores. And I guess you could say our stores are sort of struggling to keep up a bit. I mean, don't forget, it's not just about the cost, right? Mm. It's also some of the labels. For example, Neiman Marcus offers Alexander McQueen and Stella McCartney. So from what I understand, those are two very popular
labels. Well, I was going to say, the thing in this kind of business is that most of what these stores sell is international products, you know, by international designers. So there's almost very little incentive for people to support local stores. And, you know, given that Al Meyer and DJs have been so slow to develop their online business, they're really starting behind the eight ball, aren't they?
Look, they certainly are. Now, to their credit, they are trying real hard. I know that that doesn't always pay the bills, but David Jones is targeting 10%. They're currently at 2% of their sales coming from the internet. Now, they are breaking even on that online business, which is a positive. So they're heading in the right direction. And certainly Paul Zara, who is their, first he was outgoing, now he's staying, now we're not sure, CEO.
Okay.
But, you know, that's certainly, you know, partly due to his, you know, his efforts. Maya also, they're targeting 5% of their sales to be online, and they are experiencing very strong growth there, admittedly off a very low base. But, look, as you've mentioned, a lot of the incentives to buy local are starting to disappear. So, for example, Neiman Marcus is charging no postage at all if you buy over $100 US, and judging by some of the prices of the pants that I saw on their website, that won't be hard to get to. So postage is often something people go, oh my goodness, it's coming from overseas, it's going to cost me a fortune.
Look, the main thing I wouldn't want to lose would be the DJ's Christmas window display and the Santa's cave, you know. That's the only time I go to DJ's every year.
Well, let's put it this way. These American department stores like Macy's still have their Thanksgiving Day parade, and their bricks and mortar business is still going to be an important part, because what they offer, of course, is the shopping experience. And so,
look, the luxury shopping experience,
yeah,
really.
That's right. So, I mean, yeah, look, certainly, I mean, and that it is a luxury department brand, Neiman Marcus. So, but, you know, that said, there's plenty of others coming out here and targeting Australia as well, right? I mean, and of course, people can already access the likes of Net-a-Porter and ASOS. You can expect to see, you know, continuing targeting of Australian consumers. Neiman Marcus's spokesperson said that they had a huge fan following here, and that's why a lot of the efforts are going to be in marketing. For example, fashion parades and so forth.
Yes, get things that make a splash. Yeah, well, it's going to be an interesting little competition in the next few years, and I dare say there's going to be winners and losers. Or else a merger.
Yes, we did ask Neiman Marcus about that, and they wouldn't be drawn on commenting.
Okay,
maybe next time.
Yeah. Okay. No worries. Thanks for filling us in, Kai.
No worries.
Okay, Kai Chow from the Australian Financial Review. Ellen DeGeneres may be able to get 2 million people to retweet her selfie, but for most of us, social media is still fundamentally about relating to our friends. All the same, the ways that we interact on social media are fundamentally different to how we actually interact in real life. Joanna Hayes from the blog Celibate in the City has come up with the top 5 most annoying social media habits. Hi, Joanna.
Morning, Katrina.
Now, Joanna, I think before we launch into this, that we just all need to confess that we are all guilty of these etiquette blunders from time to time.
Oh, absolutely. Mm. That's how I've managed to identify the ones that annoy me most. They're all ones that I do as well.
Oh, good. I'm feeling better now. Now, what are some of the most common bad habits on social media?
Well, I've picked my top 5 in crescending order of annoyingness.
Okay, excellent.
So the first most annoying, I think, is stalk booking. So, you know, the people that have Instagram, have Facebook, have Twitter, but they're really just there to check out what everyone else is doing.
Oh, I hate that when they've looked at things, but they don't like it or comment, and then you see them and you're telling them a story and like, oh, yeah, I saw that on Facebook. And it's like, seriously? Like, don't you have some responsibility to kind of show that you've seen something? Otherwise, it's like voyeuristic.
Exactly. It is the weird voyeurism. I think it's the unequal exchange thing. Mm. You know nothing about them because they're not updating anything.
Exactly.
But they apparently know everything about you.
And you didn't even know that they were looking until...
Exactly. Yeah. Until they're like, oh, yeah, I already know what's happened for you for the last 2 weeks. So, you know.
Yeah.
So the fourth most annoying, I think, is the travel guide. So, you know, most of us aren't in the Bahamas every day or, you know, jaunting around Paris. And I totally understand that when you're on holidays, it's super exciting. But remember how boring it used to be when Nana got out her holiday slide? That's how boring it is that I have to see 50 photos of you in Paris. I'm totally happy to see one or two. And you can take more photos than that. But the surprise is you don't have to actually share all of them on Facebook. But I admit I'm completely guilty of that. So anyway,
okay. Moving on. What about photos of kids, Joanna? Why do I feel like that's going to be the next thing?
Oh, well, actually, that's a couple more away. There's two things before that.
All right, so yep.
My third, like, most annoying on the way to the most annoying is this thing called Godwin's Law. So way back in 1995, before most social media got started, a guy already observed that in any online argument, within about 20 minutes, people will start comparing people to Hitler. So, you know, it's those, oh, let's have a really intense theological or political discussion on Facebook where none of us have met, I don't know the tone in your voice, and it escalates to the point where people are comparing people to Hitler.
That's so true. Do you know the thing that gets me is when, you know, people who never like or comment on anything that you ever do suddenly jump down your throat the minute you say something that they don't agree with? Do you know what I mean? I'm like, if you're my friend, then you have a right to give me your opinion and I'll respect that. But when you're the person who has never once, you know, interacted with me, you know what I mean?
Yeah, totally. And look, I'm absolutely guilty of having massive arguments on Facebook, but I do try to only actually interact with people that I know in real life on that sort of basis. And yeah, so I think at least on the recipient end, I've been more the recipient of total stranger to me jumping down my throat thing. And it is really weird. And I think means that it's not a particularly constructive discussion.
Well, that's probably true. All right, what's number two?
So number two is the selfie addict. We all know one of these. And look, I think the worst offenders are gym junkies who take a photo of themselves every time they've had a run or gone to the gym. And the thing is that it is a photo of themselves. So, look, I have a couple of friends who, like, might do the Bay Run or run somewhere beautiful and have a photo of this is where I ran today. Look, that's lovely. Then I get to see the scenery. But it's the photo of you looking, you know, all sporty.
But her tone's taut and terrific.
Every day, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, and so what's the number one? I think I can see it coming, Joanna.
So it's true. The number one most annoying thing is baby overload. I love babies too, and I, again, am super guilty of posting lots of photos of my niece and nephew online.
Mm.
But the thing that actually annoys me is when it's like, okay, I've seen a photo of your baby today. That's lovely. Oh, one photo of your baby. Oh, look, he's looking very cute in that little sailor outfit or whatever. The overload is when we have 30 photos taken within 5 minutes of each other.
Yep.
Surprise, your baby still looks the same. You know, there's ways to make sure that not your entire followers befriend you. And one of them is not uploading each photo singly.
Yes, true.
Okay. You're a killer on Instagram.
All right, Joanna. Yeah, I can see all of that. Now, look, we need to wrap it up, but just so we're not being totally negative, what would you say is a good guide for positive ways to interact?
Well, you know, yeah, Facebook and Twitter and Instagram are wonderful ways, as you said, to keep up with family and friends. I have friends overseas. I have family all around the place. So I do love being able to keep up with them. But, yeah, just make sure we're low on narcissism and high on love. I think those are the things to keep in mind on social media.
Well, thanks. That's pretty conclusive. All right. Cheers, Joanna. Good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you too.
Joanna Hayes from the blog celibateinthecity.net. You can check out what she says online. There are 18,000 children in out-of-home care in New South Wales. Of these, 12,000 have been removed by a court order because it's not possible for them to stay at home. This means that due to drug or alcohol abuse, neglect, repeated domestic violence, or some other factor, their biological parent is unable to provide a safe home. Of those 12,000 children, only 78 were adopted in New South Wales last year. But that looks set to change. Prue Goward, the Minister for Family and Community Services, is on the line. Minister, why do you want to see adoption prioritised over foster care?
Because despite all the best efforts of our wonderful foster carers, and, you know, sometimes into care very traumatised by the lives they've led and also traumatised, of course, by their removal, we don't have great results from foster care. I've met children, I had a little boy yesterday who had 39 placements. I mean, this isn't just like changing school, and as you all know from your own children, there are children who don't like changing school. These children change families. They have to make new friends, get used to new rules in a house, new relatives, new neighbours, new schools, and every household culture is different. And then when things go wrong, because community services as a government agency didn't supervise them or support them very well, we often didn't find out that there was a crisis until a child got out the window. So I've met children, as I say, with 20, 30 placements, and of course they're very distressed by it, and often, I'm afraid, even more disturbed because they spend a whole childhood not knowing how to trust and not being able to attach to adults.
What kind of life outcomes do children have who have experienced multiple foster homes generally, and particularly when compared to those who are adopted?
Oh, well, look, we see lots of children in foster care who thrive. But unfortunately, they are much more likely to end up in a juvenile justice facility. They're much more likely to be homeless. They're much less likely to have finished year 12. They're much more likely to be illiterate. And 30% of girls leaving foster care are pregnant by the time they're 19. 30%, Katrina.
That's amazing.
When you think of how low the teenage pregnancy rate is in Australia, it's, you know, way under 3%. This is extraordinary, and I think that's telling you again that their lives have not been happy, whereas children who are adopted, by and large, have outcomes and results and lives just like everybody else, and that's what we want for our children.
Part of your plan is to reduce the amount of time that birth parents have to reclaim children who have been taken out of their care. Why is that a necessary step?
Well, for children under two, we're saying that we think by the time it gets to the stage where we're seriously thinking about removal, and that can often begin at birth when it's clear from the birth that the mother is not attentive or has a heroin addiction or an alcohol addiction that stops her being able to care for the baby. But if after 6 months of intensive support from us, the baby can't be cared for, then at that point, if they're under two, we would remove. Instead of putting them into foster care, remember the court by this time is looking at long-term orders and removing the child anyway until the child's 18. Instead of looking at foster care as the first priority, we would be looking at kinship care. Are there relatives who could take the child into their home and make it part of their family? And if not relatives, is there a guardian? And if not a guardian, is there somebody who would adopt? And only if all those avenues have been exhausted are we do I want us to look at foster care. Not because foster carers aren't great, but because the interests of the child say that what a child needs is one family and one home for life. It's a compelling case, Katrina, and when you meet these young people, I think it must be the first time child protection reforms were actually driven by talking to the products of the child protection system. And it's they who said that they thought that what they really wanted was a mum and a dad, that if they had to be removed from their parents, and many of them strongly supported that because they could remember how terrible life was at home, so many of them said, I wanted to be in a home where there was nobody going to knock on the door and say, you have to go. This placement's broken down. I mean, I had two little girls who'd been with the same foster carers for several years, and it was apparently a very stable placement, and then the foster carers decided to move to Sydney and couldn't afford to buy a house big enough to house the two foster children, so they just gave them back. And that's a child's family just taken away, no fault of their own. But what does that do to a child's confidence in their ability to be loved and cared for when you get traded in, you know, like a dog, like a puppy, you know, there's no room for the dog, so we pass the dog back. No room for these poor little children, so pass them back. Well, adoption and guardianship means that doesn't happen. And
yeah,
that's what's so important for kids.
Yeah, absolutely. I really appreciate your passion for child welfare. When will these changes be coming into effect?
Well, the legislation went into the Parliament last December, and they will be up for debate very shortly. I'm hopeful it will be underway by the 1st of July.
Okay, well, all the best with that. Thanks for sharing a little bit of your concern this morning.
Thank you.
Okay, that's the Minister for Family and Community Services, Prue Goward. Should it be easier to adopt in Australia? Over the past few decades, the number of local adoptions has fallen dramatically. Last year in New South Wales, only 78 children in foster care were adopted into permanent homes. But right now, there's growing momentum for change. Adoption campaigner Deborah Lee Furness has been lobbying the government. The Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, is moving to make overseas adoption more streamlined. And the New South Wales Minister for Family and Community Services, Prue Goward, is pushing to dramatically increase the number of foster children who are adopted. As she said so passionately on the Insight program, they can't wait. They've only got one childhood. On the line is Jenny, a foster carer whose young son, Sam, has been placed permanently into their care. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. Good morning, Katrina.
Why did you decide to foster a child? Was it an arduous process?
It was a long process before we finally were placed with our child, Sam. But I think we've got two biological children, but we just felt we had a space in our family that we could offer to a child who needed a new family.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why we headed down the foster care route.
What kind of circumstances did your child come from?
His mum was just in a position where she was not able to care for him. She was quite young.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was put in care from birth. Yeah.
From birth. And do you all have contact with Sam's birth mother?
Yes. Sam does have regular contact with his birth mum. We're actually in a very privileged position. That's actually a really positive thing for Sam.
Because it's not always that way, is it? I mean, on the program that I was watching on Insight, there were some people for whom it was very stressful that they had to go and see their birth mother.
Yes. And I think for a child who has experienced abuse or neglect, contact with that person can bring up memories, even memories that they don't even understand, especially if they're very young. And it can be quite traumatic to have that contact. The agencies will tell us that it's very important for them to form their identity, to maintain that contact, and it's something that foster carers need to work at as well and support the child through that. It can be very difficult, but for us it's actually very positive.
Well, that's good. How have your biological children coped with all of that?
We've always said they've been our best asset.
Okay.
They've been exceptionally helpful.
How do they help, Jenny?
Oh, just practically, go get me another nappy, just that kind of stuff. But also, just they have a real empathy about them now, because they have had to learn stuff about life and about stories in life that is quite difficult. They've also had to be very mature. They've had to hold parts of Sam's story and not share that with their peers, which I think at times has been challenging.
Would you like to adopt Sam if you could?
Yes. Yeah. Definitely. Sam's with us with our permanent orders till he's 18, so that's the most permanent kind of foster care you can do. If we could go down the adoption track, we would, and it's still on the cards maybe for discussion. But
why hasn't that happened so far?
We just haven't reached that stage in the case.
Okay.
Usually foster care, you do a couple of years in foster care, and then you suss out, is this the best thing for the child to do adoption or not? And so we haven't reached that stage of discussion yet.
What difference do you think that it would make to the situation or the relationship if you were to adopt Sam? How would it be different to how things are now?
I don't think it would be different.
Yeah.
Because our commitment to Sam has always been, you know, you're part of our family, we are your people, we're going to back you forever.
Yeah.
And so that wouldn't change. I think what it would change is that he would walk around with our last name. I think it would give him a real sense of security.
Mm-hmm.
Through a life of a child who has been placed in care, there is an uncertainty about who I am, who do I belong to, and that I think is something that will inevitably crop up at different stages during Sam's life. We deal with it little bits at a time because he's quite young now, but it will keep cropping up. To have that assurance that these are my family, that adoption assurance, I think can be very grounding.
And what would you say to someone who's thinking about going down this path of fostering or adoption?
I'd say it's tough. it'll break your heart because you have to confront issues that God didn't design the world with these kind of issues. You know, foster care was not part of his plan when he set up families, but adoption has always been part of his plan, and he adopted us into his family. And so I think it's just a natural extension of the Christian faith, especially, but also just, you know, if you have a family and your family is pretty good, and, you know, we all got our moments.
Yeah, none of us are perfect, yeah.
I definitely have my moments. Mm. But, you know, why not? Mm. You know, there's a child out there who could be shuffled from home to home to home to home, or they could be in your family and have that as a sense of belonging. So, yeah, definitely think about it.
Thank you.
Worth doing.
Good to talk to you today, Jenny.
Yep.
That's right, Jenny.
Chatting.
She's a permanent foster mum. We've been talking about the state government's push to dramatically increase the number of children in care who can be adopted. There was a time when Lance Armstrong was best known for overcoming cancer and winning the Tour de France a record 7 times. Now he's mainly known for the doping scandal that disqualified him from all those races. The Armstrong Lie is a documentary film that was mostly shot before the cyclist fell from grace. With the benefit of hindsight, it reveals a lot about what was really going on behind the scenes. Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity is on the line to review it. Hi, Simon.
Hi, Katrina.
What do we learn about the character of Lance Armstrong from this film?
Well, you learn that he's a fascinating character. The whole documentary is a really interesting kind of character study. Mm. I want to add that you wouldn't have to be interested in the sport of cycling or even sport itself to be captivated by this. But you do learn that he was an interesting guy. He's a very magnetic character. But we definitely learn that he was capable of incredible, elaborate, contrived lies. And he ruined people's lives, actually, who were the ones questioning him and saying he had done this over about a decade of this sort of denial. So it's a frightening thing to see someone who you know is lying telling it in such a way that's almost convincing, even as you know the truth.
And how do you explain that discrepancy between his squeaky clean image and what was really going on behind the scenes?
Well, it's hard to know. You're left sort of wondering. You learn things about his past. He grew up without, never knew his dad. He was raised by a single mum. He was always trying to prove himself, and that life was a bit of a fight. So he was an incredibly competitive person. So you get this sense of he was prepared to do whatever it took to get to the top. He kind of wanted to crush rivals. But you also get the feeling that he was almost trapped within this lie, so that once you tell the first lie, it becomes, from then on, I guess not only easier to tell the second one, but necessary. And then you end up in this kind of world where everyone thinks one thing of you, the truth is something very different, but there's a whole lot of reasons why you might think you've got to keep telling the lie. So I got the feeling of someone trapped within his own honesty.
Well, I was wondering how that would play out in other areas of his life, like his other relationships and his mental health and all sorts of other things.
Oh, you get the feeling by the end that he's not that sorry, though. Like, he gives the impression of someone who's sorry he was caught. And even at the end, the documentary maker, Alex Gibney, is who feels completely betrayed. He was making this film on Armstrong's comeback year, which was in 2009, after he'd had 4 years in retirement. And he'd told Gibney over and over again, like he'd told everyone else, he'd never touched drugs. And so when it all came out, Gibney said to him, "You owe me an explanation." And so the documentary sort of built around that explanation, where it's a kind of candid conversation between the two of them as Armstrong explains all of this. But what's interesting, Strainer, is the justifications, which I think are kind of broadly applied in other parts of our society these days. There's sort of a moral relativism in that he could justify it by saying, well, there's a whole lot of good things that are happening through this. So, for instance, his Live Strong Cancer Foundation raised over $300 million for cancer research. He inspired a whole lot of people who were suffering cancer, kids, and he used to visit people in the hospital.
Okay.
So I suppose there's a way in which he could say, look, you know, it's unfortunate that this is the way it's gone on, but there's a lot of good coming out of it. But you get to the end and you think, nah, it's not okay, even though there were sort of some, I guess, positive results from it. But in the end, people are saying, you know what, it was a lie.
It was a lie. All right. And just to wrap up, Simon, look, I think one of the things that this movie shows is that people loved the beautiful lie more than the ugly truth. You know, what does it say about our desire for a hero that we want to believe, you know?
Well, it does say something, doesn't it? Because we do, I think we do love it. It was a great story, unbelievable story of, you know, recovery from cancer to go and do this triumph of human endurance.
You know, and he was a good guy, you know, as well.
Yeah. He came across as a good guy. So, yeah, we do, we like the heroes, but it's probably a good lesson for all of us. You've got to be careful not to put people on a pedestal.
Yeah, and that's the thing, I guess. The more that we, you know, adore, idolise, you know, put our faith in someone, then the more it hurts when they let us down.
That's for sure. And in this case, it was a big fall. And you get the feeling at the end that Lance Armstrong is a kind of a lonely figure. He's really lost an enormous amount. And you're feeling like the cost, you know, wasn't worth it.
Anyway, well, thanks so much for filling us in on this fascinating film. It seems like there's a lot to ponder from it.
There really is, Katrina, no problem at all.
Yeah, Simon Smart from the Centre for Public Christianity talking about the feature documentary, The Armstrong Lie. It's released in cinemas on Thursday, March 13.